How are you holding up with the rigors of a publicity tour?
Well, it's just started, so a question I should be asked in about a week.
It hasn't sunk in yet.
No.
This is your first book.
First one for me, yes.
Well, I have some very good news. I found out 2 days ago over the weekend that St. Martin's Press has purchased my first novel.
Terrific.
Which was written on a...
Macintosh?
Macintosh.
How about it? Mine's written on a Macintosh, too. What's your book about?
The book is a novel. It's about H.L. Mencken. It's kind of a...
Oh.
It's a light. It's
terrific.
A light, frothy comedy, dark comedy. It's not a mystery. It's not anything as important as Odyssey. But the fact is, it was done on a Macintosh, and the Macintosh did change my life in so many ways I can't even count them. And strangely, when I purchased the Macintosh, I purchased it in 1985, and as I read your book, I realized that Apple was a company in trouble during the period that I purchased my Macintosh. I had no idea.
Many people back in 1985, when Apple had to reorganize, the computer industry was in recession. Apple was in a crisis. We'd overbuilt the number of computers for the previous Christmas that we could actually sell. And there were real doubts about what the future of Apple held for any of us who were there. Now it's 2 years later, and the market value of the company has gone from something under $850 million, which isn't too bad for a company that had only been around for 8 years. But today we've gone from that $850 million level to $7.5 billion. So a lot has happened at Apple. The company is different in many ways. It's selling into new markets that we were rejected in the past, and yet in other ways we're importantly the same.
Well, I'm glad I didn't know about those problems. But I can't tell you the number of people, when I announced that I was at last purchasing a computer, the number of people who came up to me and said, don't buy this Macintosh. You know, it's cute, but it's not really something you should have. And they steered me to Tandys and K-Pros and Compacts and all of that. But I had the advantage of sitting with the Macintosh at a friend's house and playing with it for a whole afternoon. We didn't know how to use it very well, but I could see right away that it was the best computer. And I looked at all. I almost was interested in the Apple IIc. But I'd gone to all the department stores and computer stores, and I began looking at all these various computers, and the Mac was so different.
Well, there were several things we had to overcome before we started to see the large sales surge that we're experiencing today. First of all, many people weren't sure Apple was going to be around as a long-term player. No one wants to buy a computer from a company that may not be around. Well, we've pretty well settled that question in people's minds because the company is doing extremely well. But equally importantly, people said, the Macintosh is an interesting product, but I think it's a toy, and I want to do serious kinds of things. So we had to demonstrate that it was more than an exciting revolutionary technology. It was something that actually was functional, that could solve real problems for people in personal productivity. And that's probably the biggest change that we've made in the product itself, that the original Macintosh was consumed with its technology and showing off the ease of use, as we describe it, the graphics, the pointing device with the mouse, and there wasn't much power left over for the kind of software that people wanted to be able to use. When we came out with the Macintosh Plus in the beginning of 1986, we solved a lot of those problems, more memory, more disk drive capacity, a faster speed. And then most recently this year, we came out with the Macintosh SE and the Macintosh 2, and suddenly we had a family of tremendously powerful Macintoshes, and they were getting accepted in corporate America, the very place that people said that we'd never be able to sell them. So no longer is the Macintosh a toy. In fact, it has become such a strong concept that even IBM changed their entire product line to make it look more like the Macintosh and walked away from what had been the so-called industry standard for the previous 5 or 6 years. So it's had some revolutionary impact on the industry in the last couple of years.
Well, I almost got sucked into this IBM PC Junior. You remark about that in Odyssey and how they discounted the price, and it looked so attractive that I almost fell for it. And I think you remark in Odyssey that they had promised to stand by the computer even though it was being discounted, and of course they eventually walked away from it. But the 512 wasn't bad. It was the first one I bought, and I didn't feel that was a toy. The 128 maybe with its limited memory, but the 512 was not a bad machine.
The 512 is actually a very good machine. today the cost of memory has come down enough so that we can give someone a full megabyte of memory for the kind of prices that they had to pay for 512 of memory just a few years ago. And perhaps that makes sense because the software applications are requiring more and more memory, giving you more choices of what you can do with multitasking capabilities, with the ability to have several different programs running on the computer at the same time, so you can switch from one application to the next without having to shut the computer down and relaunch a new application. So people are having no trouble finding out what to do with that additional memory, but it's true, the Macintosh 512 was and still is a very good product. What was missing at that time, though, was that we didn't have a rich range of application software. And it wasn't until we got products like Microsoft Excel, until we got breakthrough concepts like Aldus PageMaker, that suddenly people realized why the Macintosh technology was not just easier to use, but it also did things better, and even things that you couldn't do on any other personal computer. And that's when the sales surge of Macintosh began.
Now, in 1984, I believe, you were with Pepsi. You did fly out to Cupertino, and you talked to the brass out there, including Steve Jobs. I think that was where you first heard about the Macintosh, which they were working on. But you actually saw the Macintosh for the first time in New York, didn't you?
No.
At the Carlyle Hotel?
I actually saw in the January of 1983 Lisa, which was the predecessor to Macintosh, just before it was going to be introduced. And I saw the prototype of Macintosh about 3 weeks later out in Silicon Valley when I visited Steve Jobs and Mike Markla and some of the other early members of the Apple team. This is at the time that I was being courted by Apple to come join the company. And I remember Steve Jobs said, "I want you to see the neatest thing that I've ever been a part of in my whole life." And we walked into this room and he unzipped a suitcase which had what appeared to be a computer inside, and brought this thing out and set it on the table and looked at me with this gloating smile, waiting for me to react. And my first reaction was, this looks like a 1952 television set. It didn't look like anything very impressive to me because I didn't know very much about computers at that point. I had an Apple II Plus. I could do a few things on it, but I didn't really know very much about computer technology and what was possible with computers. And it wasn't until the Macintosh was booted up with some software and we started to look at it and we saw that it could do things you couldn't do on any other computer, particularly down in the price range that the Macintosh was going to be positioned at, that suddenly I saw that he really was talking about not an evolutionary product, but a revolutionary new concept. And Steve's vision from the beginning had been that we will change the world one person, one computer at a time, and that the Macintosh was going to have the same impact on society in the late 20th century that the telephone had on society back in the late 19th century, that it was going to be one of those products that if you asked people before they saw it how it would change their lives, people said, well, I don't know why you need a telephone. We've got telegraph keys. You know, what could anybody possibly want with a device that you can talk into and listen to a conversation that goes hundreds of miles across the country? And yet we know 100 years later that we couldn't get along without it. Steve's vision for personal computing was much the same way. He believed that personal computing would eventually change people's behavior of how they communicate, learn, work in ways that they couldn't get along without it by the early 21st century. And despite the fact that he's no longer with Apple, his visions are just as solid today as they were when he first conceived them. So my first introduction to Macintosh may not have been quite as exciting as Steve would have hoped, but once I did see the product and understand the vision, I shared the same passion he did, and it's one I still share today.
Well, you went out there as president, and of course the Macintosh was still in the process of being developed, but wasn't that a foolhardy step when you think about it, based on what you knew at the time? Apple is such a small company compared to IBM, and they're starting this revolutionary new machine that, well, as you know, the critics said it's like a toy. The 128 was a toy. And couldn't that have really jeopardized Apple's health, economic health?
Well, I knew at the time that I joined Apple that it was going to be a controversial decision to leave Pepsi, where I had been president and CEO for the previous 5 years. But I had no idea the uproar it was going to create within corporate America, because corporate America was absolutely shocked. You know, how could somebody walk away from what everyone in corporate America would aspire to, which is to move up through the hierarchy, to go join a bunch of kids who were running a company that they'd started in a garage just a few years ago to build something called a personal computer that no one really understood very well, even back in 1983. So it was controversial, to say the least. And as I got into Apple, I was to soon discover that controversy was what we were going to be living with all the time, that we were going to be making decisions that were literally going to be betting the future of the company, that if we were wrong, the company could fail and even potentially go out of business. And if we were right, the company could be fabulously successful. And this was the kind of mindset that so many people had in Silicon Valley back in the early to mid-1980s. When we introduced the Macintosh, we saw it as not a betting the company risk that suddenly Apple would disappear. The Apple II was still selling very well at that time, but we saw it as a real bet for the future. It wasn't until later on, in the end of 1984, when the Macintosh had pretty good early acceptance, where the Apple IIc, which we'd introduced that previous spring, was also getting pretty good acceptance, that Steve and I said, you know, we really ought to go for it. We don't know how high up is. Both of us thought this was going to be a great consumer products industry. That's why I was recruited. I came from a consumer products background, selling soft drinks, not computers, but I was used to selling to the Pepsi generation, and in many ways we thought the Apple generation could be created as we had created a Pepsi generation.
Sugared water for kids, I think Steve Jobs described your job.
Well, Steve was appealing, I guess, to my romantic instincts when he said, and I turned him down to join the company. He said, do you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and we're going to change the world?
Because you had very little to lose when you think about it, with a million-dollar salary, $1 million up front, and $1 million separation pay. If it didn't work out, you were fixed for life.
Well, in one sense, I guess that's true. The financial rewards were extremely attractive. But on the other hand, as Jerry Roach, the headhunter who had recruited me for Apple, told me when I said, Jerry, what if this doesn't work out? You know, can you help me get a job back in corporate America? And he said, John, you don't understand. This is a one-way trip. You know, if you succeed, you can do anything that you could possibly imagine back in corporate America, if that's what you choose to do. But if you fail, nobody's going to want you back. And my contract with Apple stipulates that I can recruit you in, but I'm not allowed to recruit people out of Apple. So you're on your own. And I looked at the financial package with Apple really as offsetting a lot of what I was giving up at Pepsi. I was giving up, you know, pension. I was giving up, other financial incentives, which were of a long-term nature, which would, you know, be impossible for me to take advantage of after I left Pepsi. And if I did fail, all that money was going to do was to provide me a bridge to get into something else. But that something else wasn't going to be back in corporate America. Nobody would want me again.
Well, you've written in Odyssey an unusual book for a CEO, because you reveal your salary, you reveal the emotional trauma of trying to deal with a headstrong genius such as Steve Jobs. And this is not what CEOs usually write about, is it? I mean, usually they keep their information very close to the vest. Why did you decide to reveal all?
A lot of people who think about writing books look at it as a monument to their career. It's looking back and preserving what they had done to show a record of their accomplishments. I think I'm still in the prime of my life. I'm not ready to hang it up yet. I didn't write this book to tell the history of Apple, nor to tell the history of Pepsi. I wrote it to talk about the possibilities of the future and to reach out to middle managers, to students, to people who have just begun their careers, who are going to be hitting their stride out in the early 21st century, and who may have some self-doubts that our leaders of today, whether they're corporate leaders or political leaders or leaders in academia, you know, are maybe not making the right decisions for the world they're going to live in. And what I wanted to show was that there are some options, there are some alternative courses that have to do with creativity and innovation and third wave companies and ideas that at the moment are considered contrarian and sometimes very unconventional by the traditionalists in corporate America. And I'd like to reach out to some of those people and perhaps inspire them to take a chance, to not lock themselves up to a life that's tied to a rigid institution, but to stick their neck out and be a risk taker and realize that the leaders of this new third wave are going to have to be very different than the leaders of our second wave industrial age companies. It's no longer a hierarchy with an autocratic CEO at the top. The John Wayne image of a CEO being invincible, making no mistakes, being wronged by others but never being wrong themselves will no longer apply, because in the third wave, the information age, we're finding that change is so rapid that we have to be risk takers in order to succeed. And when you take risks, you're going to make mistakes. And the leaders in the third wave are going to have to be able to recover quickly from those mistakes. They're going to have to be able to make mistakes and not lose their self-confidence. They're going to have to learn from those mistakes. And they have to have a vision in which to reference their actions within. And these are concepts which just aren't getting the priority of attention amongst our leaders today. And that's what I wanted to speak out. So my book is really a book of adventure and ideas and the future, not a book of what I've accomplished in the past. And to do it right, I had to reveal a lot more of myself than perhaps others would like to, but it was the only way I could tell the story with any real honesty.
Well, that all sounds good, what you just said, but the fact of the matter is most people do like the juicy stuff, don't they?
Odyssey,
you have some juicy information in here.
Odyssey is a story, and it's also a book of ideas. The story, for many of us who are involved with high technology, is part of America's folk legend now. Apple helped shape the personal computer industry. There are a lot of personalities that are still alive today who are active in the computer industry, and people are interested. They're not anonymous figures in the past. So perhaps the personal side of the book is a lot more revealing and telling, and people do like the kind of dynasty aspects of it, or even the soap opera connotations that it has. But I wouldn't have written it if that's all the book was about, if there wasn't something more to it that would have some impact on people beyond just hearing a good, juicy story.
Well, you did sneak in a lot of your business philosophy in there, and there were subtle ways of doing it. I noticed that the margins are not reconciled on the philosophical side, and the dramatic side, they are. So there are some subtle ways that you've differentiated the book. And you actually have two books here intertwined. But while there is a high drama from a technological sense, there is also high drama on a personal sense, and that is the bitter relationship that you developed, unfortunately, with Steve Jobs. Did you find when this happened that there were sides that were taken at Apple, one side yours, the other side Jobs? There were, in effect, armed camps?
When Apple was in crisis in 1985, there was a lot of fear by people as to what lay ahead. Many had a dual feeling towards Steve. On the one hand, they regarded him as this outspoken visionary who saw the world with a boldness that few had seen before, particularly in terms of the role that technology could have in empowering individuals. On the other hand, they saw someone who was not tested as a manager, someone who didn't have the experience to necessarily manage the company through a crisis, even though he'd had the skills to be able to create the company in the first place. So there was a divided group out there. As they looked at me, they weren't really sure that they could trust that I could provide what they joined Apple for. On the one hand, they saw me as the friend of Steve Jobs, the two of us having an almost inseparable relationship with each other, sharing, you know, a common passion for what computers could do. And on the other hand, they said, here's the guy from corporate America. here's the professional manager who's coming in to sanitize us of the things that we care about. Some people left. Some people decided that Apple wasn't the place that they wanted to stay. And other people stayed, but stayed with self-doubts. And it probably wasn't, Don, until a good 6 to 9 months later that we started to see a change in people's attitudes, that Apple was getting through more than just a crisis, that we hadn't abandoned the dreams, that we weren't going to compromise and turn into another clone company, that we weren't going to try to turn Apple into another East Coast corporate America version of what a corporation should be. And slowly the levels of trust grew. And then, as we demonstrated over the next couple of years, that we weren't abandoning innovation, and in fact, we've actually shipped more innovative products in the last 2 years than we have since the company was founded. Suddenly, we've had more than just a passive support. Suddenly, we had tremendous enthusiasm, and many people have returned to Apple who left at the time of the turmoil. Others have gone on to start third-party companies to create software products for the Macintosh or hardware peripherals for the Macintosh, and we've been able to attract enthusiasts who never knew Apple before the turmoil. And this is probably more rewarding to me than anything else, because we're demonstrating that the company is still led with a vision and a passion that it began with. And maybe the founders aren't there anymore, but it doesn't mean that we've turned into something that they couldn't have been proud of when they first created Apple.
I imagine you'll be reading Steve Jobs' book with a great amount of interest.
Well, if he writes one.
Well, he's got to. what is the, you mentioned that a lot of people left, and I also noticed that you say that there is no pension plan at Apple. How is the pay scale? I mean, are you able to, I know you attract enough inventive people to be able to create things like the Macintosh and HyperCard and all of that, but in terms of corporate salaries and or employee salaries, where does Apple stand?
Apple is one of the best symbols of a high-risk, high-reward environment. Our people come to Apple not for a lifetime career, so they don't think in terms of pensions. The average age of all of our employees worldwide is still only 29. At some companies, that would be years of service. But at Apple, they're coming for maybe 3, 4, 5 years, and then they want to go start their own companies. The commitment they're making is that while they are at Apple, that they're going to do their very personal best, that they're going to take risks and be innovative, and they expect to be rewarded in return. So we have the broadest use of stock options of any corporation our size. We have profit sharing. We have special bonuses when unusual achievements have been accomplished by individuals or small teams. And all of this adds up to an extremely attractive compensation alternative to what one would have in traditional corporate America. So maybe it doesn't have the security long-term that you would find in a more traditional corporation, but it does have the high rewards that go along with the higher risks of the kind of industry that we're in.
Now, about the book Odyssey, you made no bones about it, that Odyssey was a group project, and in fact you had a writer, John Byrne. Tell me how this book was put together and who worked with you on it and how it developed.
Well, I looked at many different business books before I agreed to start on Odyssey. And what I saw was that they were either written by people who had never experienced the events themselves. They were observers. For instance, Alvin Toffler identified the third wave back in the early 1970s with Future Shock. John Nesbitt with Megatrends gave evidence that it really existed. But I said, hey, I'm living it. I mean, it's really happening, and they were right. But I can tell it from the first person. But I'd never written a book before. I had no experience of writing a long manuscript. And I felt that when I had done my best work in the past, it had always been a collaborative type effort. And this was really the only way that I wanted to undertake writing a book. So I first looked for the best editor I could find. And I found a lady named Harriet Rubin from Harper & Row, who had done a number of outstanding business books and other books. Had just finished a book with David Stockman at that time before she started with me. And we talked about the concept of what the book ought to be and sort of laid out the structure. Then we said we wanted to find a co-writer, and we found John Byrne, who was the management editor at Business Week magazine. And over the next year, the three of us worked together. For John, it was a full-time project. He took a leave from Business Week. For Harriet, it was almost all of our time. And for me, it was part-time, getting up at 4 o'clock in the mornings. We were all connected with Macintosh computers over modems. I couldn't have done it without the technology. I would write for about an hour each day and send it to them, and then they would work on it and send rewrites back to me. I did over 2,000 pages of transcripts with a court reporter. We created over 50 cassette tapes that I would make along the way. Because you have to keep in mind that when we started the book, no one knew how it was going to end. In fact, I remember turning to Harriet and John one time when we were meeting. I said, I can't wait until we finish this book. I'm dying to know how it turns out. Because we were writing it in real time. We were borrowing ideas in an eclectic way from other people at Apple. We were creating ideas and creating solutions as problems occurred. And it was an extraordinarily wonderful opportunity to be able to write something and know that you have to create the material while it was going on, not just chronicle what had happened in the past. So for me, it was a wonderful learning experience. It was a forcing mechanism to articulate ideas that I probably wouldn't have needed to articulate otherwise. And it was all happening while I was trying to coalesce my own thinking in terms of what should the vision of Apple be in the future. And I'm not talking a year or 2 years, but, you know, out by the end of the century. So it was a very, very exciting project. And I think that the journey of writing the book was perhaps more exciting than having written it. I think when you do something that's really fun and when you're finished, there's a little bit of a letdown. You say, it's over. You know, what do I do next? And that's sort of how I felt, I think all of us did, when Odyssey was finished. You know, we had so much fun creating it that when it was all done, we sort of felt this little bit of disappointment.
Well, I guess the only person not interviewed for the book is Stephen Jobs. Have you anything get back to you? I assume Stephen has read the book. But
Well, I sent Steve a copy of the book.
Inscribed, I hope.
Yes. I hope Steve reads it, but I don't have any assurance that he has. We had a terribly close friendship, and it's one that ended with me having to abandon our friendship in order to take a different course with the company. And it was not done without, you know, a lot of painful experience and feelings between Steve and I. So we really haven't talked with one another since that time, which is over 2 years. And I can't tell you that Steve will ever read this book. But anyone who has read it will discover that this is not a kiss-and-tell, mean book. To the contrary, while it talks about some very personal things that occurred between the two of us, it's a book which still puts Steve into perspective, into a context, as the visionary, as the one who created more than a company, who really set the course for an entire industry, and shows his weakness and my weakness and the mistakes we made and hopefully the things we learned from those mistakes. But it also, I think, puts him into context for history in a way that no one has ever done before.
Well, we're almost out of time, John Scully, so I'd like to kind of wrap things up by asking you when we can expect to have a true laptop Macintosh with enough battery power that you can take it to the beach or any place you want.
Well, there are a lot of laptop computers on the market today, but they are computers that don't demand the high-resolution graphics that people have become accustomed to with the Macintosh. As soon as the screen technology will let us display an image without compromising what people have become accustomed to with a desktop Macintosh, and as soon as we have the battery technology, which will allow us to create that kind of screen technology without having to limit the amount of time people will be able to use it without plugging in and recharging it, then we'll be able to bring out a laptop product. It's not because we don't recognize a real desire in the marketplace or wouldn't like to sell such a product. It's that the technology just isn't good enough yet for us to bring out a product that won't compromise what's been expected from Macintosh. So I think over the next year or so, the technology will come together. We'll be able to do something like that, but certainly no time sooner.
Well, the current laptop Macintoshes are just configured Macintoshes, and they haven't gotten very good reviews.
Well, the current ones are not manufactured by Apple. What some third-party companies have done is to take our Macintosh Plus and to disassemble it and then repackage it into a more attaché type configuration. And they're still pretty expensive. Some of them have pretty good screens, but they still require being plugged in the wall. But it's only a matter of time until we can bring a product at a more affordable price point than some of these specialty products are, and one that doesn't have to compromise on what we would have to do with laptop technology today. But it will take a bit of time.
Now, I believe you say in Odyssey that Apple is about 18 months ahead of IBM, but technologically speaking, but what's going to happen in the future? Are you going to keep this lead?
I think we can. I think HyperCard is perhaps the best evidence of that. Just when people were saying, well, IBM is trying to make their products look more like the Macintosh, suddenly Apple introduces HyperCard, and the game's changed again, because HyperCard is a revolutionary technology that in many respects is at least as exciting as the introduction of the original Macintosh itself. And it's a technology which is bundled in with every Macintosh we sell. And for those who have already bought Macintoshes, they can buy it at our cost, which is $49. So it's going to be incorporated into more and more software applications. It's an erector set of tools that people who know nothing about computer programming can start to write their own scripts or programs. It's going to serve as the front-end technology to compact disks. It'll be used for communications products. It'll be used in education, in business, in government applications, by individuals. It's probably going to be one of the major technologies for the rest of the 1980s and one of the platform technologies for the 1990s. So this is just another example of how Apple is going to continue to push the envelope of technology further and further out. And it's true, as you said, that IBM did introduce a very exciting round of hardware products. The problem is we're in a system software generation of technology, and that technology isn't ready yet. And they are about 18 months away from being able to do what we can do with a Macintosh today. But the real question is not when will they do what Macintosh can do today, but what is Macintosh going to be doing some 18 months from now, and how are they going to match up against that? And
all right, give us a clue. What are some of the surprises that we can expect?
I think you can expect to see Apple continue to take products that are becoming more and more complex in the technology as they connect into other computers, and yet not make that technology aware to the user. You know, we're going to make the product more and more intuitive, continue to enhance the user interface, continue to do things that will make it possible eventually to have artificial intelligence capability, to be able to use sound in ways that sound has never been used on personal computers. All these designed to make it more friendly, more attractive for people to bring the personal computer into their everyday way of living, whether it's to learn or to communicate or to work.
Well, it's a wonderful book, John Sculley. I almost couldn't put it down. I started in the middle. I started with the Awesome Mac and finished it to the end, and then I started at the beginning. I'm not advising my listeners to do it that way, though. That's not what you're supposed to. You're supposed to start at page one and go all the way through. It's a wonderful book, and I learned a lot from it about Apple and the machines and about yourself. Thank you very much for spending this time with me.
Thank you, John.